This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. A team of archaeologists led by University of Cincinnati researchers made a remarkable discovery in the summer of 2015, a Bronze Age warrior's tomb in southwestern Greece. It's described as one of the richest tombs found in Greece in the last 50 years and a possible gateway to civilizations. Joining us to discuss the importance of the tomb, dating to approximately 1450 BC and dubbed the Grave of the Griffin Warrior at the Palace of Nestor near Pylos, Greece, are directors of the archaeological project, Dr. Sharon Stocker, University of Cincinnati Department of Classics Senior Research Associate and UC Classics Department Head, and Carl W. Blagan Professor of Greek Archaeology, Dr. Jack Davis. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sherry and Jack, thank you so much for being here to share this really amazing story with us. And your husband and wife team.
We are, yes, indeed.
That is really, really neat.
And we have been for a while.
Yeah. You have been for a while. That makes me want to add, as far as this discovery, how long did it take you to unearth this? I mean, how many years were you working in the Pylos region before you found this tomb?
We've been working there for about 25 years, mostly with old material from previous excavations, and we started our own project in 2015 and found the corner of this on the very first day.
Why is this?
We had come back. We had come to Pylos in about 2000, was it? About the year 2000 that we... No, what am I saying?
Yeah.
No, we came to Pylos.
Get
the story straight. No, we came to Pylos in, I'm losing track of time.
1991.
And our previous project is where we met.
Well, how long have both of you been involved in archaeology?
I've been involved in it for about 30 years. Jack is older than I am, and so he has a lot more experience.
Just a little bit, because today's Sherry's birthday. I was a graduate student at the University of Cincinnati in the early 1970s, and Sherry was a graduate student in the early 1980s. But we did not meet in Cincinnati. We met in Greece.
You actually met on one of your projects.
Yeah.
Now, why is this called the Grave of the Griffin Warrior?
It's called the Grave of the Griffin Warrior because we thought that it was important to have something to identify it with. And we found a number of representations of griffins among the grave goods that were buried with this particular individual.
But do we know exactly who was buried at this site?
We don't, because it's pre-literacy. And so we have no written records that indicate who he was. So everything we know about him will be through scientific analysis and analysis of the objects that he was buried with.
It's actually kind of a funny story. Well, Sherry did most of the excavation in the grave over a period of 6 months. It's one of the longest excavations anyone's ever heard of, continuous. But a couple of our supporters and friends came to visit. And one of them, who's a New York publisher, was sending emails to his wife throughout the process. And she, back in New York, came up with the name Griffin Warrior, Grave of the Griffin Warrior, and emailed him back, and he suggested it to us, and it was a darn good name for
so
the grave.
It stuck. It is impressive.
Absolutely.
Now, what's the significance of the Palace of Nestor?
Oh, well, the Palace of Nestor... is the best preserved palace of the Greek Bronze Age civilization, and it is for certain. It was uncertain in antiquity. It was called Pylos. It is the place called Pylos, and we know about Pylos from the Homeric tales, from the Odyssey and the Iliad, as the home of the legendary king King Nestor. Except King Nestor's home was sought for. Decades and decades, actually well over a century. The German archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann looked for it at the end of the 19th century, but it was finally discovered by Cincinnatian Carl Blagan, who began excavations there in 1939. And on the very first day of his excavation, he discovered an archive room of accidentally baked clay tablets written in a very early script, which represents a very early form of the Greek language. and that palace was destroyed around 1200 BC. So the grave of the Griffin Warrior, when Sherry said that we're in a period of a pre-literate period, we're talking about 300 years or more than 300 years earlier than that palace, and at that point, writing had not been developed on the Greek mainland.
Mm-hmm. Why is this considered to be a gateway to other civilizations?
Because the palace society that Jack was just talking about, the Mycenaeans, used the first written form of Greek, and so that evolved into what we think of as a classical Greek democracy, which, you know, led to a lot of the institutions that we have today. So this is really the beginning when the ideas were being formed about the Mycenaeans and the cultural elements that some of which we see later on that were reflected in Homer and then, of course, later on into the classical period around 500 BC.
And one thing that's interesting about the period of the grave of the Griffin Warrior, it's a time that people living on the Greek mainland they're adopting ideas and ways of thinking from other surrounding civilizations. They're coming into contact with Egypt, for instance, for the first time, and the Near East, what we call the coastal Levant, which is today Israel and Syria, and Jordan. But they're taking ideas from these places, but more than anything from the island of Crete, where the older Minoan civilization has been flourishing for several centuries before, and they're blending them together. And it's that blend that is really what gives rise to the earliest civilized society on European soil in Greece.
So what was it like when you first entered the tomb? Tell us about that. That had to just be an exciting moment.
It was absolutely thrilling. And I worked in the grave for about 6 months, in the beginning with some other students from Cincinnati who were with us. And then after they had to leave, I worked in there by myself. And it was just incredible. I mean, day after day, we came up with just beautiful objects, stones and gold and silver and bronze. And the very first day, when they hit bronze artifacts that indicated to us that we had an unplundered tomb, the team was just ecstatic. It was super, super, super interesting and exciting.
Yeah, Sherry and I were at the, we're told that we were at the bank, but I think we were so dazed that day that our recollection may not be entirely clear. But I think we were at the bank getting money to pay workmen, and we got a text message on our phone from a couple of the UC students who were overseeing the excavation. We didn't think there was anything. We thought it was probably a looted grave. We thought they'd get to the bottom and find nothing. And that text message was, come quick. We found bronze. And we went running down. Mm. And it was truly amazing. One never really hopes to find anything like this in the course of one's career. It wasn't at all why we were excavating. And when you said, Mark, that nothing like this has been found in the last 50 years, that's true. Since the 1950s, when very rich graves were found at Mycenae itself, was probably the last time that an early grave of this sort with such richness was uncovered. But of course, when you first find it, you have no idea what you're up against. You know, it could be a couple bronze vessels, but we didn't at all expect that it would go on and on and on through the summer. This was back in May, and it went on till the end of October. And after the students and after the help that we had available departed, Sherry was stuck or privileged to continue digging in there by herself through one of the hottest summers that we've experienced in Greece for a very long time. She ended up actually in the hospital with heat exhaustion for one day. She doesn't want to admit that, but it's true. Such was her dedication to the task.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guest this afternoon, Dr. Sharon Stocker, University of Cincinnati Department of Classics Senior Research Associate and UC Classics Department Head, and Carl W. Blagan Professor of Greek Archaeology, Dr. Jack Davis. Jack, when you first were working on this, did you have any idea it was a tomb, or did you I think you indicated you weren't quite sure what you had at first.
That's certainly true. We thought we had some sort of a small room.
Well, there were four or five stones that were exposed on the surface of the earth after we had cleared the field before the team came. And so along with our field director and the area director, we decided to put a trench in there. And we really had no idea what we were going to uncover.
So how many items did you find in this tomb?
Well, we have probably, including beads, we probably have about 2,000 things. There are well over 1,000 beads, and it's difficult because a lot of the bronze had been smashed by the earth that fell on top of it, and so we've only now just begun the process of reconstruction. So certainly we've given out over 2,400 catalog numbers, but I think that that number will decrease as we make joins and put things together.
Yeah, let's not denigrate beads.
No, not at all. I mean, beads are wonderful.
Well, yeah, maybe we should tell them a little bit about some of the types of beads.
Sure. You can be a little more specific, sure.
Okay, well, we've got amethyst. We've got amber, which comes from the Baltic, so it travels a long distance. We have agate, carnelian, which is red and is beautiful. We have glass, which we think is blue. So we would have had all of the colors in there. The amethyst would have given us the purple. And we have a large variety of gold beads. So I think that it's clear that color was very important in the Mycenaean period, and they wanted to get a wide range of objects that that would have been highly visible. And this was part of the burial custom, the display of one's wealth.
Okay, I was going to ask about that. Why would they bury so many valuable things in the tomb with this person?
Sure, and it's a custom of the time to be buried with one's wealth, and we see that decreasing over time. So by the time of the Palace of Nestor, people are still being buried with objects, but nothing anywhere near as opulent as what we see here.
Yeah, they mostly get kind of crummy clay vases by that point. what's amazing about this particular tomb is there are no clay vases. It's extraordinary. And some of the craftsmanship that is applied in the construction of some of the objects is truly stupendous. Sherry mentioned the gold beads, but the gold beads are themselves works of art with granulation, which is a technique that we don't see for a very long time after this particular period. Techniques that we didn't think were being practiced in the Eastern Mediterranean during this period have appeared in some of these objects.
So what was were the gold beads the most significant thing, or what was the most significant thing you discovered?
Well, all of it is significant, but we found four gold rings buried with this individual, which is absolutely amazing. There's only one instance of someone being buried with so many rings. And these are all images of the Minoan period, scenes probably that are religious. So this is something I think that stands out among the goods that we found. We also found two gold cups. So this individual was indeed very, very wealthy.
And how many silver?
I don't know. We have probably about six silver vessels, and silver was very rare at this time also.
Mm-hmm. And there's some of the rings are one of the rings is the second largest gold ring ever found in the Greek Bronze Age, and it's a couple 2.5 inches long. It's stupendous. It's a scene of ritual on the island of Crete with a goddess and her followers dancing and singing and saluting toward a shrine, a religious shrine at the back of a bay by the sea, with palm trees flanking it on either side. These are things that are helping scholars who are interested in reconstructing the earliest religious practices in Europe to do so, just because of the simple detail of the representations.
What happens to all these items that have been unearthed?
Well, they stay in Greece, of course, and the most precious objects have been taken to a larger museum in the nearby city because they have better guards and better facilities for that. And some of the objects have been moved to Athens, to a place at the American School of Classical Studies, where we can begin the process of conservation. And then some of the bronze has remained in the local museum, where we'll also be able to do conservation.
Mm-hmm. Any chance this becomes an exhibit that we might see in Cincinnati someday?
We hope. We hope. That would be great.
Well, somebody suggested that. The Onassis Foundation approached us when we were in New York, and the J. Paul Getty Villa has expressed interest. So it's possible. But the amount of conservation... what was I feeling while she was digging the grave? I was constantly absorbed with the cost of the whole venture. I thought, oh my Lord, what this is going to cost in terms of conservation to take care of this material.
Absolutely.
Recently, Sherry brought some objects to Athens, where it's actually easier to have certain types of conservation done, and we have swords and we have daggers and. Some of the production techniques that are used are very, very rare. One of the hilts of one of the swords is done in a technique called gold embroidery, and they used, I have no idea, thousands of teeny tiny staples which were pressed into wood in order to create a pattern that looked like embroidery, and then they engraved a picture on top of that. And we're not quite sure what the picture is yet because we haven't been able to carry out the conservation fully.
Could this change the current thinking about that period of time? Anything that you found that might change the way historians and look at this period?
Well, I think it changes the view of the centrality of the southwestern Peloponnese, because until now we've always looked at Mycenae, which is in the Arglid, more in the eastern part of Greece, and thought that that was really where all of the civilizing forces were at work. And what we're seeing is that there were different places in the southern Peloponnese at this time that were very important centers and had access to a great deal of wealth. And Pylos is one of them, and they found a new Mycenaean palace near Sparta, probably the palace of Menelaus, who's also mentioned in the Iliad and the Odyssey. So, yeah, I think we're going to need to reevaluate how we look at the Mycenaean period and what we think about the big picture overall.
Yeah, I think another interesting aspect of this is that although if we roll the clock back to 1939, the time of Carl Blagan when the palace was constructed, Blagan and many of his contemporaries imagined that the Mycenaean civilization, Europe's earliest, sprung organically from the Greek soil and was somehow an expression of a latent, inherent abilities of Greeks in particular. Now the picture is looking much more complicated. The Mycenaean civilization was Greek speaking for sure, but the Minoan civilization was not, and it predates the civilization on the mainland. So I think we're seeing that. What arose as the Mycenaean civilization was a combination, an agglomeration of influences, both of people who spoke the Greek language and people who didn't, which is actually not so very different from what happens in historical Greek times. As Greek speakers, the mainlanders were very skilled at taking little bits and pieces of things that they found around the Eastern Mediterranean and recombining them in different and very interesting ways to produce art and to produce culture.
Jack, we've got about 30 seconds left. You'll be giving a talk next week, and you want to give us some details on that?
Yeah, thank you very much, Mark. Yes, Sherry and I are giving
both a talk. Both of you will be giving a talk.
Yeah, we're both giving a talk, and it's open to the public, and it's at the Taft Humanities Center, which is in Edwards 1 on the first floor, and on the UC campus. And there's parking at 51 West Corey Boulevard in the Corey Street garage, which is adjacent to Edwards.
So that's
Edwards
the 18th, the 18th on, at 4:30.
On the 18th at 4:30. Thank you very much.
Sherry and Jack, thank you for being here this afternoon. Dr. Sharon Stocker, University of Cincinnati Department of Classics Senior Research Associate and UC Classics Department Head, and Carl W. Blagan, Professor of Greek Archaeology, Dr. Jack Davis. You can find links to more information about their discovery at WVXU.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show. Belinda Kai was the assistant producer. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Each Friday on Cincinnati Edition, we present an in-depth discussion of the developments behind the headlines. This week, we'll look at the upcoming agenda of the new Hamilton County Board of Commissioners, which is now controlled by Democrats for just the second time in more than 40 years. We'll also discuss the latest top stories affecting Northern Kentucky. That's our weekly news review on the next Cincinnati Edition, Friday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.